Time for Sports Lit 101. Very excited to talk with the author of this wonderful book who joins us right now. He's the author of a number of books, including Freedom Riders, 1961, and The Struggle for Racial Justice, and The Sound of Freedom, Marian Anderson, The Lincoln Memorial, and The Concert That Awakened America. His new book is an incredibly thorough analysis of both the career and the life of the legendary Arthur Ashe, called Arthur Ashe, A Life. We're pleased to be joined by Raymond Arsenal. Raymond, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And joining us from an apparently just concluded baseball game, right?
Yes, I just saw the Rays lose to the Royals, but can't win them all.
No, the Rays playing awfully well, and they've got reason to be optimistic, I think, about their season.
They look good, definitely.
Let's talk about this book. It really is a remarkable work, and you know what stunned me, and I kept going back to this time and time again, is to think about everything that Arthur Ashe accomplished in his life and did all that in just 49 years.
It really is astonishing. Alexander Hamilton also died at 49. And you think about these two incredible human beings who packed so much into their lives. Arthur, I think, the last quarter century of his life, from 1968 on, lived every day almost like it was his last. He just was almost obsessed with making a difference in the world. And if you look at his daily logbooks, it's hard to imagine that any human being could keep up that pace for very long, but he did.
One of the great things, this is Bruce, one of the great things, Ray, about the book is the way that you make the Jim Crow South to be as vividly in the reader's mind. Man, I'm old enough to have been there. I know what it's about. My mother's from Alabama. But I thought the way that you portrayed this, it really set up for the reader how they could see what an incredible accomplishment just to become a mediocre tennis player it would have been for Arthur Ashe, no less than to succeed.
That's right. I think he really had no business in even dreaming the dreams that he did coming out of Jim Crow Richmond. The life he sort of envisioned didn't exist, you know, and it was cradle-to-grave segregation, and no one like him had ever been able to have a career in tennis. Of course, when he came up, there was no open tennis, so hard to imagine that he thought he could make a living. But even the notoriety, the fame, the influence that he had, the notion that someday there'd be a statue to him on Monument Avenue amidst all of the Confederate brigadiers and Jefferson Davis and Stonewall Jackson and was unthinkable. But he had an inner drive, I think, even though he was reticent as a young boy and man and was never a braggart, never a loud talker, better listener, really, than he was a talker, although he became a very fine talker later in his life. But there was something in him that he really came to believe in himself, and against all odds, he pulled it off in an extraordinary way.
Well, and to me, that's what makes this so very interesting. His story is that we think of everything he did in the sphere of civil rights, but the journey was not a straight line. And as you mentioned, it was not a position he envisioned himself being in as a young man.
No, he had a very authoritarian father. They grew close late in life, but he was really quite scared of his father in the early years. His mother died when he was six, and he very much was very obedient and was told, you know, keep his eye on the ball, literally and figuratively. And his coach, Dr. J. Robert Johnson, the same person who discovered Althea Gibson earlier, always told them, you know, you can't afford to make any noise. You can't afford to have any upset. If you're playing a white boy and the white boy hits the ball just outside the line, you call it in. It's better to lose the point or lose the game or even the match than to have some sort of racial incident which will block the way for others that will follow you. And his father always told him, stay away from that civil rights mess, as he called it. And it was really only in 1968 that I think, as Arthur became more famous and he realized that other black young men and women, you know, were braving the fire hoses and tack dogs in Birmingham, And with the assassinations of Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy in 1968, something snapped in Arthur. He took a turn towards activism, and he never looked back. I mean, that was his main identity, even though he spent a lot of time, obviously, playing and winning tennis matches. But the things that really mattered to him were to use tennis as a platform where he could have influence and for social justice and economic justice. And he was involved in so many things that I think people never even realized. He never seemed to be able to say no to anyone. Any kind of inner city workshop or anybody who asked him for money for a good cause, he was always there. And I, as he once said, it was part of it was a compensation for his inaction as a young athlete, which is very common. Obviously, you're making your way up the ladder. You don't think you have time for politics. But as he said, as my fame rose, so did my anguish. As my fame rose, so did my anguish. And he did everything he could to catch up to his responsibilities as an African American and as an American citizen.
You point out in the book that Ash is really the only major African American tennis player in our consciousness for men. You know, we know Althea Gibson's story, certainly the Williams sisters, and like it's not like who's better, LeBron or Michael, right? It's with Ash, it's always just him, and I think sometimes his real talent as a tennis player gets overlooked just because he didn't have 10 Wimbledon titles or all those things. Do you think that besides being underappreciated, perhaps as a social figure, he's also underappreciated as an athlete?
Perhaps a bit. Of course, he doesn't fit the mold. He's, you know, he was 6'1", 155 pounds.
Right.
You know, wore glasses through most of his life. He looked more like a professor or an accountant than a world class athlete. And of course, that I think was part of his ability to break racial barriers, and because he wasn't a threatening physical figure, he looked like the public intellectual that he was. But his approach to the game was, he's often called an elegant player, and he was. He wanted to win. He had a competitive spirit, but more than that, he wanted to hit the perfect shot. Oftentimes he took chances that no non-risk taking player would take. And so oftentimes he came in second. He'd be runner-up a lot of the times, and he probably could have won more tournaments if he had been more functional, more pragmatic. But he loved the game, and he loved all aspects of it. And it wasn't just winning for him. He was not a win-at-all-costs person. He really cared about the beauty of the game. Of course, as John McPhee shows in his wonderful book Levels of the Game about Arthur playing Clark Graebner in 1968 in the semifinals of the U.S. Open, the first U.S. Open, that he did ultimately win that one. But he was just a person who thought on a very deep level about what things mattered, the meaning of things, and sometimes winning got in the way. And so he certainly won his share, 51 tournaments, and he won 5 majors, 2 in doubles and 3 in singles. And, of course, the great upset of Jimmy Connors in 1975 at Wimbledon, and winning the first U.S. Open and winning the Australian in 1970. So, but it was never about winning tennis matches for him.
Well, and that was reflected, too, and I really enjoyed aspects of the book dealing with his relationship with competitors on the tour and the fact that he never liked Jimmy Connors, but not for his behavior on the court or anything like that. It was because of, most of all, his love of money over everything else.
That's right. You know, Arthur was not one to hold a grudge or really to get angry, to raise his voice. I'm sure inside he was very turbulent, but outside he was always cool and calm and collected, the Mr. Cool, as some people called him. And he hardly ever said anything negative about anybody, but the exception was Jimmy Connors. He thought Jimmy Connors was unpatriotic relative to the Davis Cup competition, that he was putting all the other players at risk by being so money-oriented. And he had certain sympathy for him because they were both outsiders, in a sense. Connors really came from outside the country club circuit, and he was kind of rough cut and, kind of a riverboat gambler. And Arthur, of course, being African-American, even though he became something obvious of an insider, being the head of the Association for Tennis Professionals and the most beloved player in the game. But still, he was, as he was known as a young junior Davis Cup player, he was the shadow. He was the shadow to everyone else's light. And he knew that even early, even late in life, in his autobiography that he wrote with Arnold Rampersad a few months before he died in 1993, he shocked some of his close friends when he said, you know, despite contracting AIDS from a blood transfusion, that has not been the great tragedy of my life. That has not been the biggest burden of my life. Race has been the biggest burden. And they were stunned, this coming from a man who'd become a multimillionaire and was loved by everyone and seemed to be able to negotiate the boundaries between races almost effortlessly. But actually, clearly, that was not the case, that he was always very sensitive about what was really going on in interpersonal relationships, and he really felt the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow and the inequities, and was, that's why I think he was so committed to so many social justice organizations and doing everything he could, and particularly in South Africa, of course, which was his number one cause to bring down apartheid in South Africa, and eventually became a close friend of Nelson Mandela's, and that was the high point of his life, I believe.
You point out in the book a number of times, this is a very bright man, a man who could study difficult subjects and could manage to do this while he was playing both competitive college tennis and international tennis. Is he really one, when we think about him, one of the more intellectually gifted athletes of his era?
I would say so. Not necessarily intellectually gifted in the sense that it helped him to play tennis. In fact,
right.
Many tennis writers pointed out that if he did less thinking and more kind of impulsive playing, he probably would have won more points and more matches. He couldn't take the non-intellectual route, and that may have gotten him in trouble in some senses on the court. Sometimes he didn't really trust so much his instinctual notions of what he should do, but off the court, you know, he was the leading public intellectual among American athletes for sure. You know, I mean, he had correspondence with philosophers and other scholars and historians and you name it. And he collected first editions. He was compulsive about doing the New York Times crossword puzzle every day. He would often do it in the locker room. And can you imagine the sort of Jimmy Connors coming by and seeing what Arthur's doing between matches? Compared to what he and perhaps even John McEnroe were doing, and even, for example, the other probably person who was intellectually inclined was Ilie Anastasi. They had a lot of conflicts in the court, but they had a certain coming together and sort of understood each other because they both were interested in, you know, maybe more scholarly endeavors and reading and arts and letters. But he was the real deal. You know, I mean, he was always had a book in front of him. He didn't have to put on any airs. That's who he was. I think it made him so distinctive and I think so special, and why he was so adamant about other athletes speaking out. You know, I think if he were here today, he'd be a very strong supporter of Colin Kaepernick and LeBron James and Stephen Curry. And, you know, he'd be right there on the line with them. For Black Lives Matter and other causes, because he really believed that athletes should not just be like court jesters who were entertainers, but they should use their celebrity, not just the celebrity, but their opportunity to be heard. Only, of course, if they had something substantial to say, but he knew enough about the other athletes that he played with, and he had great respect for many of the people on the tour who were dear friends, and some of them, you know, when I interviewed them for the book, several of them broke down in tears before I could even ask them a question. They would be talking about, you know, that they'd apologize. Say, look, I'm always this way when someone asks me about Arthur. He was probably the best person I ever met. He changed my life just knowing him. I only wish I could have been more like him.
Well, as you also note, he took it from both sides within the African-American community. I mean, there were those who thought that by going to South Africa and trying to make sure he could play there and engaging them, he took flack from what we might call the left. He had people on who wanted him to j- just shut up and be a good tennis player and not cause any waves. Can you think of anyone who ever negotiated that more skillfully?
Well, I mean, I think he did do it in a very skillful manner. I mean, he suffered a lot of criticism in the early years. He was one of the first Americans to really get deeply involved with the anti-apartheid movement. But he believed in contact, not in sort of isolating the South Africans, taking advantage of their sort of almost fanatic love of sports. And he later changed his mind. I mean, he realized that engagement was not going to work. Particularly after it was taken over as a slogan by Ronald Reagan, whom he did not respect, and of course Arthur was a very liberal Democrat. But the striking thing to me is that he did change his mind, and he was willing to admit that he felt he had probably been wrong or maybe too optimistic in his early years. He had such a deliberative mind. I can't tell you how many interviewees that I told me that he was the best listener that they ever knew. That he would never interrupt. He'd look you in the eye. He'd listen to you. He would really listen in the sense that he would take other people's views into account. So he was never an ideologue, never really an absolutist about anything, even though he had very strong opinions. And he was a truth teller in almost every aspect of his life. But, you know, he was not bullheaded in any way. You know, he was really just, I had a kind of openness, a kind of civility that we could all wish to have and admire. He really was the paragon of civility, not just the sportsmanship on the court, but in his entire life. And I think that's why he had so many friends who loved him in a way that maybe friendships don't always experience. He was really one of the most unusual, I think, public figures of the 20th century in the United States.
We're talking with Raymond Arsenault about his wonderful new book, Arthur Ashe, A Life. Hard to believe it's been a quarter century since Arthur Ashe died. If we project ahead another 25 years down the road, do you think Arthur Ashe will be best remembered for his career as a tennis player or for his activism?
I suspect, in a way, it'll be for his activism. We're so quantitatively oriented that the fact that someone else has 13 or 15 or 18 majors, that seems to put the other people in the dust, so to speak, behind them. And so Arthur, I think certainly qualifies as a good, even great tennis player, but not one of the greatest of all time. Where his real true greatness showed was, of course, in the way he conducted himself on the court and what he did off the court. I mean, he along with Muhammad Ali, probably is the most obvious example of an athlete who transcended the world of sports, and that really used sports as an avenue to something higher or something maybe deeper in another sense. So I hope he'll be remembered for his tennis. That's how I was first attracted to him when I was a graduate student in the 1970s. And one of my closest friends was a dead ringer for Ashe. They looked like twins almost. An African-American friend and who I dedicate the book to, actually, who sort of introduced me to the cult of Ashe. But I think he had too, Jim Horton was his name, he's now deceased, was attracted not just to Arthur as a tennis player, and of course Jim always wore Arthur Ashe tennis clothes and had the Ashe racket. He looked just like Ashe. But I think it was the deeper qualities that really was something that he admired and wanted to emulate. And I hope people in the future we'll see that. I think the fact that we have the ESPN, the ESPY Courage Awards for Arthur Ashe every year, and there are several other awards, and of course the statues to him in Richmond and in New York, and the largest stadium named for him. I hope people will see that as something beyond tennis, that here was a tennis person who became, one of the great persons in American history. Over the last century, I would say.
Well, it's a fascinating story and a wonderful read. Raymond, we thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate you making time this afternoon.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's been great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And if you talk to Ted before I do, say hey.
Okay, I sure will. I'll give him a call.
Thanks again. It's Raymond Arsenault. The book is Arthur Ashe, A Life, here on Sports Lit 101.